From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. It's easy to take water for granted. It still flows cheaply into your home, and the Mississippi River is an easily accessible and cheap form of recreation. But that's not the case around the world, where access to water is shrinking. Some think water will soon be the new oil. The League of Women Voters of the La Crosse area recently held a lecture featuring Mark Schultz of Onalaska. He's volunteered to serve with many resource conservation groups, including the Mississippi River Citizens Commission. He set out to answer the question, who owns the water? Here's a part of the talk.
We have water in three places, essentially. Water in the atmosphere, then we have surface water, which is out here, and then you have groundwater, and that's right below our feet. And depending on whether it's in the atmosphere, surface water, or groundwater, the law treats it very differently, even though we know that it's all connected. When the law first started, the underpinnings of the law first started, they didn't recognize that. But I did run across an article that was written about a little bit about the history of water. It says, the history of people's relation to water illustrates varied approaches to the management of water resources. The Etruscans had a deep knowledge of hydrology and hydraulics. Now, the Etruscans are the folks that built Rome, so that's a while back. A knowledge that they put to good use in their many land drainage schemes. The lower-lying portions of Rome, such as the area between the capital and Velia, was formerly marshland. Settlement of the low-lying ground would never have been possible without the hydraulic engineering of the Etruscans. So when people say, you know, the technology and our knowledge of science has been recent, that's not true. And so the excuse was, well, we buried it there because we didn't think there was any problem with it. Well, yeah, you knew, but you just didn't care. As like the old Isle of Plume landfill, which now is have to be, it's like a brownfield, and they're going to have to dig it out if they want to get the pollution out of it. This took place around 625 BCE, then according to archaeology evidence, a network of drainage channels was dug through the marshy ground, and at the same time, the stream that was separating the two hills of the Capitoline and Palatine was regulated. Its embankments were strengthened and was finally covered over. And then there's evidence in the Netherlands that they started that water engineering some time ago, and they actually drained an area of 45,000 acres and became a potluck. In 1899 was construction of the first Aswan Dam that began to address agricultural and energy shortages exacerbated by the growth of Egypt. But when they built the dam, they cut off the silt to the floodplain, and so now they have to put on 1 million pounds of artificial fertilizer rather than getting the silt and the nutrients from the Nile River. So when you do water management, there's always a yin and a yang, a good and a bad. So that's a little bit about history. And we have areas in southwest United States where there were cultures of Native Americans, and they had managed their water, but then they hit a dry period, and essentially that culture disappeared because they no longer had a source of water. And when you look to Central America, and they've come to the same conclusions, was that their management of water was such that when you hit a dry period, there's no water, and if you don't have water as a culture, you're kind of out of luck. That gets us to the law. And in Wisconsin, the Constitution directly addresses the Mississippi River. It mentions that the Mississippi River and its tributaries shall be forever free. That is to say that I can navigate on the Mississippi River and its tributaries, and I can't be charged anything for doing so. That has a long history of conflict between railroads, logging, navigation, cranberry interests, and then drainage schemes. So that all happened in the 1800s. Then in the 1900s, we had a big surge of growth. And what happened shortly after 1900, along came the automobile. We started building roads everywhere, roads and bridges. And bridges are impediment to stream flow if you don't make them large enough. So we had years and years of lawsuits over water rights between railroads and logging companies and cranberry drainage and navigation folks, because the steamboats all wanted to go upriver, and they didn't like it when there were bridges across or when the logging companies built dams and let the water go and then filled the stream with sediment. And that's sort of how our water law has evolved. And that's why a lot of the water is public, because it was in the public domain, and the state of Wisconsin reserved the water to be the property of the people. And how did we get to be the property of the people? Well, our legal system comes from Europe. And in Europe, the king owned everything. Only in the United States, the people are the king. So that's why the wild game, the water, and the land under lakes are all owned by the public. And that's where the public trust doctrine evolved from. And who's in charge of the public trust doctrine? The legislature. Are you happy?
Sometimes, yes, sometimes not.
And so the trustee, the legislature, if it follows certain rules, can allocate the water as it sees fit, as long as it follows certain rules. And a good example of that is if somebody wants to build a dam, they need to get a license. And if the dam happens to be for power, then that license grants ownership for that power production to whoever has the license. And I can tell you firsthand that the folks out on Lake Neshonnik used to want to lower and raise the level of the water to kind of control the carp. And they did so before North American Hydro owned the dam. And then North American Hydro came along and they put in generators so that they could generate power. But it turned out that when the Lake District wanted to lower the lake, the power company said, fine, just pay us for the lost power. And, of course, that would have been more than the Lake District could afford. So that's why I say who owns the water, it depends. It depends on whether there's been a license granted. It depends on what the trustee, the state of Wisconsin, has done with that. Another example that everybody here might all know, and you know where the Frank Lloyd Wright Center is in Madison? Well, that's sitting on Lake Monona Lake bottom. Well, theoretically, that bottom was owned by the public. But a long time ago, they granted that piece of land to the city. Today, I don't think that would fly. So anyway, I always call that the Frank Lloyd Wright illegal fill. But, so let's get down to some of the differences, the regional differences in water law. And in the east of the United States, and a good example is what's happening right now in Atlanta. In the east of the United States, it's called the riparian doctrine. And the riparian doctrine is based on very plentiful water. Everybody's got enough. And in the riparian doctrine, if you own a piece of land that abuts a stream, you can use the water as much as you want, but you have to return it all, and in the same condition, okay? And there's a difference out west. And there's also what used to be what's called the common enemy rule in dealing with stormwater or runoff water, okay? So the common enemy rule was, if it's on my land, I can push it off on your land, and no problem. Well, now with stormwater regulations and with recognition that, well, doing that is not only harmful to the person downstream, it's also harmful to water quality and other things, that's been modified by the stormwater regulations. So you have two kinds of law that are made. You have constitutional or court-made law, and you have statutory or legislative-made law. And the two of those don't always agree or get along. We have the West, which is the prior appropriation doctrine. And the West is an area that has not got lots of water. It's got very little water compared to the amount of land it's got. So what you do out there is the first one that gets there gets the water, and they establish their claim to the water. Now, if you can imagine, if you're in a wet period out there, everybody comes out and starts using the water for irrigation or drinking or whatever it is they're using it for, and then all of a sudden hit a dry period, you realize that we've appropriated more water than we have. So we end up with these arguments over who owns what water. The last thing considered out there is the public. You may have a farm here and a farm here and a city here. They fight over the water, but the public use purposes, which is fish and wildlife and drinking water, seem to be the bottom consideration. Where is Wisconsin in the United States? It's in the middle, right? So you got eastern water law and you got western water law. And they sort of meet at the Mississippi River. And so our water law has been evolving and changing, and you can get articles written by folks from out west that criticize the eastern water law, and you get folks that out east that criticize the western water law. And what we find is that over time, that legislators grab a piece from this and a piece from that and put things together in statutes to deal with some particular issue that it has at the time. There's two powers of government. Police power, and that's the power to regulate. Power to give you a parking ticket out there if you stayed too long. The power to issue a permit to fill an area. The power of to give you a license to generate power. That's all part of the police power. The other power of government is eminent domain. Eminent domain is essentially that they come in and say, okay, we need that for public purposes. We'll pay you a reasonable cost for that, so we're going to exercise the power of eminent domain. And is everybody familiar? This is just a sidetrack. Is anybody familiar with the CAP 2020 and the power line controversy? Well, why are public utilities public utilities? Anybody know? Because they use the power of government to get their assets. It takes an act of the legislature to give them the power of government so they can use eminent domain, because otherwise they'd never be able to acquire the power line or whatever else. It's the same way with if they're going to do a hydro project and they have to buy the land behind the dam, they need the power of eminent domain. Same way as cities use power of eminent domain to get a piece for a road or whatever. So that's why public utilities are public, and they're not really private. But sometimes they don't know that. In Wisconsin, there's several chapters that deal with the statutory law of water, but the major chapter is Chapter 30. And it's the one, when you talk to the folks from DNR, they'll say, oh, that's a Chapter 30 permit. And a Chapter 30 permit might be a wetland fill, it might be dredging out a lake, it might be those kinds of things. And that's essentially done through the Department of Natural Resources, and you go through a quasi-judicial process, and there's a hearing examiner, and then if you don't like the decision, you can take them to court. Now, at the same time that we have been evolving water law, we've also evolved our knowledge about water. So surface water, yeah, that was public. Groundwater, that was whoever owned the land. But now we're finding that that science has evolved, and we find that there's a real connection between surface water and groundwater. Anybody know why the rivers flow in the wintertime when everything's frozen? It's simply groundwater that's discharging to the stream. Otherwise, you're not having any precipitation that's melted. So most rivers and lakes are groundwater that's being discharged. So there's a direct connection between groundwater and streams. And if you think about it, if the groundwater is contaminated, the fish and wildlife need that quality water in the wintertime. That's when they're most vulnerable. And that's why it's so important to protect groundwater quality. Plus the fact that you need it for drinking. We don't get most of our groundwater from surface waters. We get them from groundwater, or our drinking water, that is. And then we have the impact of technology. Back in when this was being settled, we had navigation by canoe and barge and a few steamboats. And we had railroads. We didn't have any horses. We had horses. But the other technology that impacted water wasn't around. Now today you've got all kinds of technology, the ability to change a land surface, to redirect runoff. The city of Waukesha recently went through a whole legislative procedure to try to get the water out of Lake Michigan, because the city of Waukesha sits outside the Lake Michigan drainage basin. And in Wisconsin, you can't transfer water from one basin to the other. But I think they made an exception for Waukesha because they're running out of groundwater. They don't have enough groundwater for their people. We have better science, more technology, many more uses that are made of water. We have growth happening all over the place. And that makes higher demands on water. So all of a sudden now, that Eastern water law that relied on plentiful supply, we don't have that plentiful supply as much anymore. We have conflicts between users. So without the regulatory approach, the power of government, the power of the police power, we wouldn't be able to resolve a lot of those conflicts in use. There's a couple of examples of those conflicts that have happened in the last 30 years. Is anybody familiar with the Tommy Bartlett case? I was in the ground floor on that. I was an intern in working for DNR law enforcement. But essentially what happened there was Tommy Bartlett was authorized by the village of Lake Delton to use a portion of the surface water for their water ski show and to exclude everybody else. And some of the fishermen there and some of the residents said, wait a minute, you can't do that. Those are public waters. You, village, don't have enough authority from the state, who's the trustee, to do that. Well, it turned out that they did, according to the Supreme Court. But that's where the public's waters are now allocated for a private use, essentially, because Tommy Bartlett was pretty important to the village of Lake Delton from an economic basis. The other one was a case called Michael's Pipeline, and what they were doing was putting the pipe in the ground, and they were dewatering, and they were essentially discharging the water over a land surface onto somebody else's land. And that's where there was a connection made, finally, between regulation of groundwater and the groundwater movement and the regulation of surface waters and the responsibility of who's ever dealing with the groundwater, that you need to do that in a responsible fashion. Who owns the water, again, depends a lot on the situation that you're in. Now, I know there's a real movement to privatize water. Not so much in the United States, but particularly in the developing countries. Have anybody heard of those situations in Africa, South America? And I have no clue what's going on in China. In fact, I have no idea what the Chinese legal system is even like. But they do have some serious water problems in China. And we in the United States, we've had the Great Lakes Compact, which was essentially to direct that the water from the Great Lakes was supposed to stay within the basin. But I know that there's been nothing done like that for the Mississippi River. And I know that there's been regional authorities down in southwestern United States who have looked towards the Mississippi River and the Missouri River and look at last year in the flood stage, and they're saying, here, we're dying for water, and you guys got more than you want. Can't you share some of it with us? And that's going to be the next real major fight that I see, is what's going to happen with this water out here, because it has none of the protections as the Great Lakes has. And we have to get the attention of our state government to actually realize that the West Coast has got some water on it and some water that somebody else wants. In Waukesha, there was a system set up. They went through the system. They proved that transfer out of the Great Lakes wasn't going to be that harmful, so they allowed it. But if you don't have a system set up to allocate this resource and somebody comes along and they've got more political power than you've got, then you may lose that allocation to go someplace else. Now, I'm sure that the navigation interests and the fish and wildlife interests and the recreation tourism interests aren't going to want that. But it's whatever happens in Congress. Because just like the state of Wisconsin, in the legislature, in Congress, they're the trustee for the national allocation. And the big clause that's really important is the Commerce Clause. I want to read you this article that was done by a judge down in Atlanta. He's a former Federal Energy Regulatory Commission member and a Social Security Administration member. His name is Alan J. White. And he's talking about, are you guys familiar with Lake Lanier in Atlanta? Essentially, in the last drought, it completely dried up. And Atlanta was really hurting for water, and they wanted to get water out of the Tennessee River, but that's an interbasin transfer. And essentially, they were told, no, you can't have any water out of the Tennessee River. So here's the article. I'm tired of the misinformation I read about Atlanta's water lows. The politics are horribly uninformed, and the journalism is even worse, because neither the politicians nor the journalists have bothered to enlighten themselves as to Atlanta's legal water entitlements. Let me begin by explaining that water law in the eastern and western United States are completely different. Eastern water law, which includes the law of the origin of the original states, is derived from the English common law and may be characterized as a law of riparian rights. Briefly, as in the United Kingdom, it is based on waterways that flow throughout the year. Owners of land through which and adjacent to which waters flow have the right to use the water and virtually any purpose, but they are obligated to receive the flows from above and are also obligated to permit the flows to continue below. Now, in the West, you can use the water up. You don't have to return it. Western water law may be characterized as a law of prior appropriation and is generally applicable to areas that were once owned by the United States. In other words, we had the Western lands, and they were all U.S. lands before the settlement, is derived from the fact many waterways obtain their flows from the melt of winter snows and dry up when the melt is gone. Because of federal laws in the 1800s, water rights were separated from the title to lands owned by the United States, and therefore no water rights passed to subsequent owners of those lands. And that's the difference between ownership of land and water in the East and land and water in the West. You may own the land, but if you don't have the water rights, you got a bunch of dry land. Briefly, many years ago, a person in entity would appropriate a quantity of water from a waterway for a specified purpose. The first person or entity to do so would have a right to use the first quantity of seasonal water for that purpose, the second person or entity to the second quantity, and so on. If the person or entity with a prior appropriation did not use the appropriation or for the specified purpose, the second appropriator would become senior, at least for a given season. In other words, if you had a right and you didn't use it, you lose it. It's the old use it or lose it. The recent court decision ruling that Atlanta had been tapping Lake Lanier illegally is both correct and incorrect. It is correct insofar as it deprives Atlanta from the benefits of the storage at Lake Lanier because Atlanta did not contribute to the construction of the development, but it is incorrect insofar as it deprives Atlanta of the quantity of the Chattahoochee River in which withdrawing when the development was being planned. So Atlanta always used water from the Chattahoochee. Lake Lanier stored that water, and somehow the court interpreted that they had no right to any water, which seems a little illogical, but courts aren't always logical. Apparently, the judge's rationale paralleled the Western law of prior appropriation, in which the appropriator of the quantity of water has the right to build a dam on the appropriator's land to store the seasonal water until it's used for the appropriated purpose. And because Atlanta did not contribute to the development, Atlanta did not entitle to a share of the water. Atlanta's prelinear withdrawals from the Chattahoochee are insufficient for today's needs and for the future. The supply provided by Lake Lanier is relatively finite, and additional local storage developments would likely be subject to the same weather conditions as Lake Lanier. So, and then he goes on to talk a little bit about the Corps of Engineers and the Tennessee River, and it's all logical and we can do it, but the folks in Tennessee weren't real happy with that because everybody wants their water and they don't want it diminished in any way. And that's sort of a attitude in the East, whereas out West the attitude is it's for everybody's good. So those folks that get to it first, they use it. So what happens, and this, when we were out in Las Vegas the last time, there was 30 years that they were developing this, they were buying up water rights so that Las Vegas could have the water. And they spent 30 years doing it. They were about to close the deal, and the court said, go back and start over. And so right now, Las Vegas is in very hurting because they have no future source of water. They have what they have. And Hoover Dam, which is the Colorado River, is at super low levels. And eventually the federal government's going to say, sorry, you can't have that either. That's the Commerce Clause. And so when you say, who owns the water? It depends. It depends on the situation you're in. It depends on where you're at. It depends at the time of history. It really does depend on whether you have the money or not. And it depends on the will of the people to ask their legislators to make sure that they take care of the water for the future. I like to think about the future as far as everybody says, well, it's just for the kids. Well, if you think about it, it is just for the future generations. Otherwise, if we didn't have future generations, we'd just have many years of chaos and it would all be over. I've thought about that a lot, and I'm thinking, yeah, all the regulations, everything that we do, organizing, building cities, it's not for us. It's for future generations. Because if it was just for us, it wouldn't make any difference. We wouldn't have to have any laws. We'd just have chaos and it would be over.
Conservationist Mark Schultz of Onalaska recently addressed the League of Women Voters of the La Crosse area. His discussion was meant to answer the question, who owns the water? Thanks for listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes Steve Roysom, John Gatto, Mary Meehan Stroob, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. Updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us at WPR Newsmakers on Facebook.